Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
I hope everyone had a terrific weekend. The Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship Conference is quickly approaching, and we have a couple return guests to discuss the uniqueness of this event. Catherine Chilgen, author of Shakespeare Suppressed and Art Collector, is here, as well as Ramon Jimenez, author of Shakespeare's Apprenticeship. And if you want to learn more about the conference, you can go to ShakespeareOxfordFellowship.org. Hi, Catherine and Ramon, how are you?
I'm well. Good to hear
you. I'm well. I'm fine. Good to talk to you, Mark.
Yeah. Thank you for returning.
And Catherine.
Yeah.
And Ramon.
Before we talk about the conference, we need to talk a little bit about the fellowship's publication of the Oxfordian Volume 23. The contested year was a terrific compilation from the Oxford camp a few years ago, but Volume 23 is a stellar collection of essays. It really shows the diversity of topic on the authorship controversy and the talents of your colleagues. Let's just spend a little bit of time talking about the Oxfordian Volume 23. Let's see, both of you have contributions in it. Ramon,
well,
do you want to start?
Mark, the first thing to say about it is it's twice as long as any other issue of the Oxfordian, over 300 pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a book, and
it is excellent.
Yes, it's a journal trying to explore deeper the case for Edward de Vere, 17th Earl of Oxford, as the true author of the Shakespeare plays. So it's been going on for 23 years. This is our 23rd issue. And our biggest, and we hope to attract other scholars to it. we can go over a few of the topics if you like. Both Ramon and I are featured in it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. and, maybe we could just say something about a couple of the other chapters. But, just to begin, Shakespeare's sonnets are amazing pieces of literature just by themselves. maybe they should be seen as separate works of art from the plays. After getting enchanted by, the controversy, when I saw that PBS or the Frontline special in 1989, and all the books I've read about the topic since then, and talking with you two on several shows, and the Alexanders, and the sonnets really do present an entirely different personality profile of the author than what's in the traditional biography. And Ramon, you are looking at your chapter in volume 23 does look at the introduction to the sonnets, and it really is awkward, disjointed, odd punctuation. I don't want to call it like the spacing of the type. Almost really looks like what Wendy finds in Jack's stack of papers in the Overlook Hotel, where all she sees is him writing down like the left side. It was like all night light and no play makes Mark a quirky host, or something to that effect. And then like the same thing written on the right side, and right down the middle of the page in different shapes. What was, we have a couple initials worked in there too. Explain how this introduction is just so odd in trying to understand what was being the purpose of this introduction, the setup for it. It's I can see where people would want to try to interpret something that may not be there.
Well, it is the dedication you were speaking about.
Yes.
There isn't really any introduction to the sonnets. And it is, I don't know, about 14 lines. And it's a dedication. It's not so unusual when you look at other dedications printed at the same time. The triangles are very common in other dedications. Capital letters are very common. And until about 25 years ago, there was no suggestion that there was anything more to the dedication than a wish by the publisher, Thomas Thorpe, who has signed it at the bottom with his initials, TT, any more than a wish, a thank you to a Mr. W.H. who supposedly provided him with the manuscript of the sonnets, and a wish that he enjoy eternal life, such as was promised in the sonnets to the fair youth by the author of the sonnets. And as I said, about 25 years ago, John Rollett, one of our an English researcher in Ipswich, he was not an Oxfordian at the time, according to his account, but he was intrigued by the language and the shape and the topography of the sonnets, and he began to analyze the letters and the words, and he came up with a couple of conclusions, one of which was that selecting certain words out of the sonnets, he found a message that said, "These sonnets all by E. Vere the Fourth." And then he took the 144 letters of the sonnets and arranged them in various grids, that is, as anagrams, and found a grid where he found a name along one line of the letters, the name Henry. And he constructed some other grids and found the name Rosalie in three different parts on three different lines in two different directions, and concluded that there were these two messages, one about the author and the other about what most everyone thinks is the fair youth of the sonnets, Henry Rosalie. So three or four other writers joined him and agreed with him and so on. And in my essay, I looked at Rollett's research and his conclusions and concluded that he was mistaken, that there was not a hidden message about the author, and that the anagram solution did not point to Henry Rosalie. And the following article in the Oxfordian by John Cheyan elaborates on John Rollett's findings and concludes that there were two messages, one about the author and the other about the identity of the fair youth. So that is the situation at the moment. Two different views of the sonnet's dedication. It's true that it's awkwardly worded, but it seems pretty clear to me that Thomas Thorpe is thanking his associate, William Hall, W.H., for providing the manuscript. But it's not clear either way, I think. I don't think either of us is going to be able to prove our conclusions. So it's going to be a topic of discussion for some time, I think.
Well, and you do say that William Hall and Anthony Munday had they were colleagues at one of the print shops, and we also know that Munday and Edward de Vere had a long-standing connection as well. So
that's right.
There is that connection that can tie the sonnets back to de Vere instead of William Shakespeare.
Yes. That is one line of connection. True.
Yeah. So, I really enjoyed that one. I don't want to spoil the whole. Want people to read, your whole work, but I was really impressed with your chapter. I can see why someone needed to step in and straighten things out with some of the wild speculation that could be going on about the dedication. And okay, and Catherine, let's talk a little bit about, you know, your...
Well, first I just want to say that I think that the sonnet's dedication is very interesting in the sense of the phrase, all happiness in that eternity promised by our ever-living poet. And ever-living poet is totally suggests someone who is has passed away. And the Earl of Oxford, of course, in 1609, when this was printed, had passed away 5 years previously. The Stratford man was still living, and he had about seven more years to go. So it's intriguing, you know, that dedication for that purpose as well as on the title page of Shakespeare's sonnet, the name Shakespeare is hyphenated, which, you know, a hyphen between shake and spear, indicating perhaps a made-up name or a descriptive name of spear shaking. So those are also two key arguments, you know, against the Stratford man.
Okay. Good points you just brought up.
And of course,
really,
the sonnets themselves, the great author pretty much reveals that he's a nobleman, you know, that's writing in the first person.
Yeah.
And he writes that his name has been stained somehow. He writes as if he's nearing death. You know, there's a lot of giveaways in the sonnets. And I encourage your listeners, if they want to learn more about the great author, the most intimate location, you know, you can find him is reading his sonnet.
Oh yeah, it's that part of the sonnet part of the canon is fascinating, and I don't get too sidetracked, but I better not say too much. I don't want to give away all that's in your book as well. I just kind of leave it there. But yeah, you know, there. It's just looking at seeing things differently than what our English teachers in high school taught us about the sonnets, if we even read them, it becomes more easier to understand who is talking to who. But, okay, I think they're kind of getting sidetracked into too much other stuff there. Get back to your really interesting chapter on Prospero, and you know, he's the protagonist of The Tempest, which seems to be Shakespeare's retirement play, if you go by the traditional dating, and yeah, that becomes more apparent in the epilogue. But you know, some people have thought that Prospero is Shakespeare himself addressing the audience at the Globe Theater towards the end of his career. You are saying that Prospero is based on a real person. So take it from there, Catherine.
Yes, and I came across an article by an art historian named Sir Ernest Gombrich, and he was the one who came across reading a 16th century book about art that this phrase referring to a man named Prospero Visconti, and he was like a man of letters, belles lettres. And he thought, oh, interesting name, Prospero, and very learned. And he looked into a little bit more on Prospero Visconti, and who was a native of Milan. He had a library. He knew languages. He was a poet. He was kind of a Renaissance man for this period. And he thought, gee, this could be perhaps who Shakespeare was basing his Prospero on. And so he mentioned this, actually, to an English professor who was working on an edited version of The Tempest. And he showed him his evidence and said, hey, what do you think about this? And, well, I don't know what transpired, but the editor chose not to use Gombrich's idea, that, you know, possibility. So he pretty much dropped it at that point. But several years later, he came across a poem that was written to Prospero Visconti, and he referred to villainy that had taken place in his family that sort of, you know, pretty much disrupted the line of the Dukes of Milan, and that in compensation, he is serving the Muses, you know. So instead of maybe being part of a prominent ruling family, he has put this aside and just focusing on the arts. So he thought that really pointed to Prospero in The Tempest, Lord Prospero in The Tempest, who was put in exile by his brother, by the villainy of his brother. So you see these parallels. And so I picked it, you know, in my article, go into more depth about what he found and bits and pieces more about Prospero Visconti and the possibility that the Earl of Oxford may, you know, he's my Shakespeare candidate, that he may have actually met him. And so I look at letters that Oxford wrote and also letters that other people wrote about Oxford during his tour, and it points to him actually having gone to Milan. And it also, if you read the plays, there are some details in the plays that are specific to Milan that were not generally known. So it's a very good chance that the two met. I can't prove it. There's still more research to be done there. There are more letters of Prospero Visconti that have not been looked at. So I'm hoping in future someone may pick up from here, from me, and, you know, find a direct connection. But also it appears, besides Prospero Visconti, I think that his family story of villainy was actually the case, because he was a descendant of the original Dukes of Milan, the original family. And about 100 or so years after, it changed families. The Duke of Milan changed to the Sforza family, and there could have been a little bit of villainy in that process. So I think that perhaps that's what this poet was referring to. So, you know, there are these parallels. We don't know exactly what the villainy was, but it could very well have been the change in families of the Dukedom of Milan. And, of course,
okay.
Prospero in the Tempest was the exiled Duke of Milan. So who just
Catherine,
like the
did you say
had a huge library. Prospero Visconti had a library. They were both famous. They both studied the liberal arts. They were noblemen, you know. And the name Prospero was unusual. So I think that they may have met, actually. They were alive at the same time, and Oxford took a grand tour of Europe, especially Italy. So it's a good chance. But I think there are other influences as well for Prospero in the Tempest, and that would be John Dee, Dr. John Dee. The Earl of Oxford knew Dr. Dee, and Dr. Dee delved into the supernatural, and he tried to draw up spirits. And we actually have in the British Museum, we have his spirit mirror where he would try and evoke spirits. So the Earl of Oxford may have known about that, may have watched him do it, who knows. But there was definitely an Oxford and Dr. Dee connection. And, of course, Prospero in The Tempest communicates and evokes the Ariel, who is his spirit. So we have that. One connection that is not specific to Dr. Dee or to Prospero Visconti is the exile that Prospero experienced. Well, the Earl of Oxford experienced an exile. In 1581, he was thrown in the Tower because he impregnated one of the Queen Elizabeth's attendants. And so they were imprisoned. He was imprisoned for 3 months and then was released, but he was not allowed to see the Queen or visit her court, not for at least 2 years. So that was, for him, a form of exile. So he may have put a little bit of himself in it, in the character of Prospero. And, of course, he was a magician of the theater.
Uh-huh.
Catherine, did you say that there are Visconti letters that might be seen?
Yes. In 1905, someone published several of them, and I could not find an Earl of Oxford reference. But recently, I think in the last 15 or so years, someone wrote a dissertation on Prospero Visconti, and he says that there are some letters, I believe, in Milan or Florence of Prospero. I have it in my article, that have not been looked at. He saw some of them, but there are other ones. So I think that it really, if anyone has knowledge of Italian and Latin and even German, it would be great. And if they had access to these archives, they might find a really good, you know, something really special. And there was also, he refers to a manuscript that has been lost for over 100 years that would have given Prospero Visconti's accounts of various parties and events that happened among the nobility. That one would be really wonderful to look at to see if Oxford, you know, was included. So, yeah, there's so much more research to be done about the Earl of Oxford. But every time you want to make a connection between Oxford and a character in a Shakespeare play, you can always find it. It's amazing.
Right.
Yeah, and Catherine, you were just talking about the Visconti family, and they did have a long connection to the arts. One of Prospero's uncles, or someone from the recent previous generation, was an editor of Petrarch's poems.
Yes.
And
yep. he was a courtier, nobleman courtier, and greatly interested in the arts. And he had a big library as well. So the one that Prospero Visconti had, he may have built upon it.
Yeah, and the family also worked with Bramante, so you can see why Edward de Vere, if we want to single him out as the real author of the Shakespeare plays, why he would gravitate towards the Visconti family. Nobility, similar interests in the arts.
Yes, I think there's a very good chance there is some letter or document saying that they met. It's just waiting to be found somewhere. Yeah.
Let me point out here that this new research of Catherine's is just another example of the strong connection between Oxford and the Shakespeare canon, and it's part of the strongest body of evidence that Oxford was Shakespeare was his trip to Italy, and all the plays that are set in Italy, all the details of geography and local customs, the language, and so on. And this is just another example of close connection between Oxford, Italy, and Shakespeare. And, of course, there's no evidence that Shakespeare of Stratford ever left England or knew Italian or had any interest in Italian things.
Yes, and he wouldn't have been able to learn Italian from his local grammar school. So, you know... So we
right.
wonder how he seemed to be supposedly familiar with Italian language. So,
right.
Just
right.
another
well, the Orthodox scholars speculate that he picked up all this knowledge of Italy and the Italian language from Italian merchants in pubs in London.
Yes, the great universities, right? Of the Mermaid Tavern.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So while we're still talking about Italy's influence on Shakespeare or Edward de Vere, another one of the articles in the Oxfordian volume 23 covers the Decameron. I thought that was a really interesting article or chapter. It was De Vere supposedly translated that well-known late medieval Italian work. And he translated it like 5 years before the sonnets. So, Ramon, would translating the Decameron fit into the apprenticeship that you wrote your book about? We see Shakespeare writing a lot of drafts over the years kept going back to say Richard III and rewriting it until he got it to where he wanted it. Do you think translating 100 Italian stories would be part of that apprenticeship?
Well, not that particular translation, I don't think, but it's pretty clear that Oxford was interested in translating works from foreign languages from an early age. And it's been pretty well established that he is the actual translator of Ovid's Metamorphoses that was published as a translation by his uncle, Arthur Golding, in the late 1560s. So, and that would have been done, well, Oxford was a preteen when it seems that this took place. Now, according to Waggaman, he's the author of the article you're referring to, the Did Oxford Translate Boccaccio's Decameron? And he points out that a translation, an English translation of the Decameron was registered in the Stationer's Register in 1580. At the time, Oxford was about 30. It turns out that there was no actual publication that emanated from that registration. The Stationer's Register was a publicly maintained list of books that London publishers paired for, were planning to translate, planning to publish. Publishing was extremely closely regulated at that time, and the stationers or publishers had to adhere to various requirements as to what they were going to publish, and the script, the manuscripts had to be reviewed by officials. But as Waggaman points out, a translation into English of the Decameron was not published until 1620. Was that what he said?
Yeah.
1620.
It was almost like 40 years after the translation was done.
Right. And he presents a wealth of evidence of all kinds that that translation was done by Oxford. The publication of 1620 doesn't identify the translator, so it's not clear who did it. The orthodox speculation has been that it was John Florio, but as Waggaman points out, it was a different kind of work than Florio was had been translating, and there aren't any characteristics in it that would lead one to think it was Florio, but there are dozens of words and phrases and ideas and changes in the text that seem to point to Oxford. It's a very convincing and well-written a piece.
Yeah. I thought it was a very informative chapter. You can see Waggaman does make the point of the use of alliteration in the translations. It seems like De Vere could have been starting to come into his own as a poet, and then just a few years later, he's going to start the sonnet series, you know, 150 some sonnets. I never really thought about it, but you can maybe see some kind of evolution of an artist. And then you throw in, you know, Venus and Adonis and Lucrece in there as well. It's really that 1580s to 1590s is really one of those areas of research that seems to be blossoming for the fellowship.
Well, I have to agree with you. Each issue of the Oxfordian, we see some additional research and some other aspect of the authorship question that we were unfamiliar with.
Well, I think you're filling in the gap. I think your group is putting together a timeline in those lost years that the Stratfordians really can't fill. Oh, you're doing a great job, John. And we also
it's
need
a very
to,
rich topic. I mean, it's not only, surveying the life of the Stratford man, you know, and trying to understand, you know, what his role was, and knowing the facts, but it's also the incredibly illustrious life of the Earl of Oxford, and it's so rich. Any little topic, any little aspect of it, you can just write a whole book about. very intellectually satisfying issue in general. So.
I agree. And, you know, we probably need to spend a little bit of time talking about the Chilgen portrait. Maybe some people in the audience, maybe in, our English listeners, they might be familiar with the rainbow portrait and has all the little ears and eyes all over Queen Elizabeth's outfit she's wearing. It really made her sound like she was a Facebook fact checker.
Yeah. But
in the portraits, first of all, maybe you want to tell us about you saw the portrait and, you know, what drew you into acquiring the portraits, and ask a few questions from there.
Yeah, I was interested in Oxford's portraits for several years, because there were really only two or three that were known, and a person of his high status. There should be more. So I pretty much figured out that there's got to be more out there, but just not identified as the Earl of Oxford. A portrait of a gentleman. And, of course, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Elizabethan and Jacobean portraits with of ladies and gentlemen and children even with no identity, because they didn't usually write on there. And then also the artist would rarely sign his initials or anything. So so I figured there has to be more, and so I, you know, I kept my eyes open, and I would look at, through auction catalogs, and I finally came across one, and I put it on the cover of my book Shakespeare Suppressed. He's a very extravagantly dressed nobleman. And with a tuft of hair over his forehead and a rose in his ear. And it just, it very much
red
fits
rose.
The personality, the known personality of the Earl of Oxford. And he wears a very wide ruff, which he was sort of slightly ridiculed by another writer for wearing deep, wide ruffs. But I think that in his mind, he was being somebody of fashion and probably European clothes. And Elizabeth Waugeman goes into detail about it. She even goes into what she thinks was kind of a brown curtain in the background, and she seems to think that that was something of an invitation to discover what's behind it. So I thought that was an intriguing interpretation.
Okay, and this portrait was in the custody of Oxford's granddaughter, so there seems to be some kind of, you know, like, this just wasn't coming out of just anyone's house, and they were claiming, but believe me, this is from Oxford's house. It's like there was, you know, like Rick on Pawn Stars would, you know, say, you know, let's see the documentation, like the chain of custody of ownership. But that seems to be proven.
Well, I traced, you know, who had owned the picture previously was Lord Thurso, his family. So I you know, you can look in Burke's Peerage, and you can see the family connections. And I was able to trace it all the way, yes, to the Earl of Oxford's granddaughter, the daughter of his daughter, Elizabeth Vere, and Stanley, the Earl of Derby, so the Stanley family. So I was able to trace it that far. I mean, I can't guarantee that that's where how it came, but there's definitely a connection there. Real documentary evidence actually is the hat that he's wearing. He has a hat with pearl and gold buttons, a black hat. And if you look in the Queen's Wardrobe of Robes, a logbook, which exists, there's a few of them, in 1581, July, the Queen gave the Earl of Oxford, this was just right when he came out of the Tower in 1581, she gave him a black hat with pearl and gold, you know, on the hat. So almost certainly that's what we're talking about. So I think that that's just right off the bat that's proof that this indeed is the Earl of Oxford, besides his wearing French clothing. He was known to wear French clothing, and this is has kind of a French ruff. So, yes.
And also, Elizabeth Waugeman points out in the article, or publishes a portrait of Oxford's half-sister, Catherine,
mm-hmm.
a little older than he was, and the resemblance is quite clear between the two.
Yes.
And there are many, many, there's a lot of other evidence that, that points to Oxford. The, you know, the coloring of the clothing, the, I was amazed at the luxurious materials shown in the painting. Expensive taffeta, for instance, and a lot of attention to the fabrics and the connections between items in it from Italy, from France, and from England. It really presents a man of the world, a man of the Renaissance, and with connections and influences from three countries. It's a wonderful article. I urge everyone to get hold of the copy and read it.
Okay. How do they do that?
Well, it's available on Amazon, as are the other Oxfordian editions. It's $15. I expect to get mine tomorrow, so I haven't seen the actual print copy yet. And if one is a member of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, one can see it online right now, as well as all the other issues of the Oxfordian back to 1999 or whenever it was it started. So it's readily available, and it's not expensive. And as I say, it's the size of a book.
Well, and it's quality, thought-provoking compilations of, you know, research that make up this book. Lots of these medieval or early Renaissance paintings with people with the signet rings on their middle finger. That was an interesting aspect for part of the painting, the Lancastrian red rose that Catherine was talking about. You know, the green leaves, and of course, you know, their laurel leaves. It all does fit together.
Yes, and my talk in the coming conference, you know, which is October 8th and 9th, which anybody can sign up for, it's free. I'm going to be talking about a possible new portrait of the Earl of Oxford's sister, Mary, that I came across. I think it's her. So, and as of now, we really don't know what she looks like. So I'm anxious to give that presentation.
Okay. Since we're, you know, we've kind of moved over to the speakers at the conference, they will be a lot will be presenting over Zoom, and people can watch it. You know, it's just after lunch, well, for most of October 8th and 9th, and just sit there in your jammies and sign up on the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship.org website and just sit there and watch it at your leisure. And you have a number of terrific speakers. Keir Cutler. Sounds like he has an interesting topic, like why we aren't questioning the Stratfordians. I forget what he was going to say.
Yeah, why was I never told this? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. why? You know, there we are. You know, back to all this cover-up stuff. Like, why weren't we told this? You know, why does this information? You know, where you two made a really good case about Oxford, the Earl of Oxford was the author of the play. Why is there such an emphasis on not allowing that discussion to go public?
Well, that's true. That is the latest scandal in the authorship question. Why are academic Shakespearean scholars not only contesting our research, but refusing to discuss it, refusing to publish it, refusing to allow us to present at their conferences, and also publishers of Shakespeare plays, books about Shakespeare, and journals about Shakespeare. They won't publish anyone who contests the Shakespeare of Stratford's authorship of the canon. And that is the real conspiracy. They call us conspiracy theorists, but the real conspiracy is among the hundreds and hundreds of Shakespeare scholars who refuse to discuss this question or allow us to into their different media outlets. It is quite a scandal.
Okay. Well,
yes, and meanwhile, it's really the people who have dropped the Stratford Man model who are making all the advances in research. And I think that this issue is a good example of it.
Well, you always have a home here at Nightlight to discuss. We might be your only outlet. Well, you know, besides Ramona's show on Saturday, but yeah, the two of us will keep giving you a platform because this is a fascinating subject as well as it's just really captivating. I think you over the years of you know. Us doing these discussions, you've made such a insightful presentation of just fact after fact. And Shakespeare Identified, which was written by J. Thomas Looney in the 1920, and the centenary edition was edited by James Warren. He's going to be a speaker at this year's conference. Shakespeare Identified basically was the foundation of the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship, correct?
Yes. Okay. Yes, and the organization that was formed in the following year was called the Shakespeare Fellowship.
And his James Warren's topic is The Greatest Deception in Literary History, A Contrarian's View of 1623. You know, Nightlight is frequently contrarian. But what James did for the 100th anniversary of Shakespeare Identified was really a terrific achievement. I really like that book as well. I'd like to get him as a guest at some point.
Yes, good idea.
But I think one of the most memorable statements, impacting statements for me was when he was saying, and just a younger author really isn't going to have the life experience to pull off writing this, like the early the sonnets from the 1590s. The more mature, Hamlet or King Lear, like one of those more mature plays, isn't going to be done by someone not that long out of college. You have to have a number of life experiences, and probably are going to be in your maybe later 40s or 50s before you can write anything really profound. And there are a few examples of Dante and Defoe. And I thought that was just a really excellent point that was brought up in Shakespeare Identified. That one really stuck with me.
Well, he was a very deep man. I mean, a very deep feeling person. And he was able to put himself in other people's shoes very convincingly. And that's how he came up with all these wonderful characters.
It just really seems that you need to observe life a lot for a longer time to create these masterpieces, world masterpieces that are still read 400 years later.
And performed.
Yes. Really, I think your group is really on to amazing insights into rewriting history, explaining how what was covered up and what we need to know. And is there any new research going on that you'd like to discuss, or what's that one thing that you would like to find that would make the clearest connection that De Vere was the author of the plays and sonnets?
Well, there is I would say maybe a dozen different places where further research might really make the solid connection between Oxford and the Shakespeare canon. One of them is an alleged manuscript of Twelfth Night that was referred to in the 18th century. It apparently was extant in the 18th century, and a literary scholar wrote that he was going to publish it. But he never did, and no one can find the manuscript. But he did describe it as a play about a courtier who was unhappy with the emergence of another courtier, Hatton, at Elizabeth's court, which pretty much describes roughly the plot of Twelfth Night. So that's a very close connection. And as it happens, Michael Delahoyd has edited from an Oxfordian perspective an edition of Twelfth Night, which is about to be published. And he is going to be speaking on Saturday at the conference. He's going to spend about a half hour talking about he calls it Epiphanies Whilst Editing an Oxfordian Twelfth Night. So that's something that we're all looking forward to. That to me is the most likely, if that manuscript can be found, that would be a solid connection between Oxford and the Shakespeare canon. I think that would settle the question. But as I said, there are a dozen different places, geographic places and literary places, where that connection could possibly be made with more research.
Okay. All right. So, is there anything
the Holy Grail would be to find a Shakespeare play manuscript, which does not exist. So.
Yeah, with, Edward de Vere's signature on, like, the byline.
Yeah. Or just his handwriting.
Right.
Yeah. We know what his handwriting is like. There's several letters of his that have survived. So it would be no problem to, match them. So we just need a play manuscript or a page of a play manuscript. But as far as we know, there are none.
That's just the... basically, that's the Holy Grail to find. But you think that everything else is pretty much in place. We just need that one final piece of the puzzle.
Yes, I think so. And it will only take two or three well-known Shakespeare scholars who are convinced to begin what I anticipate would be an avalanche of research into Oxford by the Shakespeare academic establishment. Once there is some proof or some close to proving of Oxford authorship, I think it's going to open up an enormous field of research for all these Shakespeare scholars who've been inspecting Shakespeare plays minutely for decades now and are running out of material. This is going to be a great boon of research once the paradigm shifts.
Okay. And I know you two have some work to do and prep for the upcoming conference, and I want to keep you up keep you away from that for too long. Is there anything else you wanted to cover, or is that good enough for you for the evening? You can give websites and plug anything, and the fellowship, and we could and I can let you get back to work.
All right, all right. I would just encourage listeners to look at the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship website. There are many articles, and all of our newsletters, all of our Oxfordian journals are available there, and it's a site that you can spend a couple hours or more exploring. And of course, the conference next month, that would be something interesting to tune into, and one can join the fellowship for a small amount of money and be a subscriber and receive the Oxfordian and our quarterly newsletter, and even come to one of our in-person conferences once they resume.
Okay. And this one is just the 2021 is just conferences can be viewed over Zoom, so you can be safe at home and just have two great days of listening to captivating lectures.
Exactly.
Okay. And Ramon, what's the name of your book again?
Oh, Shakespeare's Apprenticeship. The first five plays that Oxford wrote, teenager.
Okay. And that could be found at Amazon.
Yes.
Okay. And Catherine, how about all your website and contact information and
you can go to shakespearesuppressed.com and you can contact me through the site. And also I provide the introduction to my book, Shakespeare Suppressed, The Uncensored Truth About Shakespeare and His Works. And it's available on Amazon. Or you can get the ISBN number and Ramon's book, too. You can request it at your public library and have them buy it, too. So there's lots of ways to see our books.
Okay, cool. So I think both of you had great chapters in the volume 23, and I'm looking forward to this year's conference again. And I just want to thank you, Catherine and Ramon, for being our guests tonight. And thank you, Barbara, for producing the show. And hope everyone enjoyed the show. And we'll see. I'll see everyone Tuesday, and Barbara will see everyone on Monday for her show. And thank you again, and talk to you soon.